production.
Hello, A Life of Greatness listeners. I wanted to let you know about my private Facebook group called Live Your Life Greatly. It's a space for our community of like-minded people to give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. Search Live Your Life Greatly in Facebook groups. You can also join me on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg for daily inspiration, videos, and behind-the-scenes footage. Search Sarah Grimberg on Instagram. Leanne Moriarty is one of Australia's most acclaimed authors and the only Australian to feature as number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. Some of her books include Big Little Lies, Nine Perfect Strangers, and The Husband's Secret. With worldwide sales of over 20 million copies, her words bring life's intrinsic quirkiness and whimsy into relief right alongside life's deep-rooted seriousness. As a storyteller, she is contemplative and inspired by the stuff of daily life, schoolyard scandal to ordinary backyard barbecues. This conversation traverses many realms. It's about the nature of creativity and what drives Leanne, her philosophies on work, passion, service, and the incredible power of her words to shape culture.
Sometimes people will talk about really difficult times in their lives where my books helped get them through. Because they're easy reads, maybe they were at the hospital with a sick relative and things like that. So it's really personal and special.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Working as a podcast and radio producer, I have been fortunate enough to cross paths with many intriguing people who have had a profound impact on me. In this series, I share stories and experiences from the people who have brought inspiration to my life, and hopefully yours too. Leanne Moriarty's newest book is Apples Never Fall, a thrilling domestic drama. More than anything, this conversation shares her perspective on career longevity, her evolution as a writer, how she approaches unlocking her creativity, and the purpose that lives beneath it all. May her words inspire you to follow your own dream, lean into your imagination, and never stop learning. Leanne, you are one of Australia's most well-known and adored authors. Tell me, how did your childhood shape who you are today?
Well, I think I was shaped, first of all, by being the eldest of six children. So growing up as part of a big family, I do sometimes wonder if that gave me an interest in just in different personalities. So in the fact that we were all so different, even though we obviously had the same upbringing and the same parents, but we all had such different identities. So I think perhaps as a result of that, I'm interested in writing from multiple perspectives. So that's one side of it from how I write. There's also the fact that I grew up in a household where we're encouraged to read, not in an academic way. So it wasn't, you know, where we're all sitting around reading books and having highbrow discussions, just in the fact that my mother always took us to the library. I think it took a long time for me to realise not everybody was as lucky as that books were just a natural part of life for us. And also my dad, when he discovered that my sister and myself, that we used to like to write stories, he then encouraged us by commissioning us to write stories for him. So he'd pay a dollar for an exercise book filled with words. And then he had a roulette wheel, so he'd win back all the money. So we'd play roulette against us and win back all the money he'd paid us.
Did you like reading from when you were young? Did it come from an environment at school where you were good at it? How did that love for reading begin? Because I see my son is eight and he is obsessed with reading and he is just a moth to a flame to the extent where we have to say, do not take the book into the bathroom. Do not take the book when you're eating because he won't eat. He'll literally have one spoonful and then be face first in the book. It's such a beautiful thing and I don't see it in my daughter. So I wonder, did you feel like it was an innate thing, just having this love for reading and writing?
I think so. I do wonder how it would have been if there were as many distractions as my own children face. So that's interesting that you say that about your son. So he's obviously got those distractions, but he's still got that love of, of reading. So I don't know. I can't tell what I would have been like if I had TikTok there to distract me. But I did, and as I say, my mother took us to the library and there were books around, but Mum and Dad were far too busy. They weren't reading. I didn't see them reading at all. So, yeah, I feel like it was innate. But I often think about would I have been distracted by TikTok is that even now I have to make an effort sometimes to put down the phone because it's so addictive, especially in current times where you can get caught up with the doom scrolling. And then that's when I think, well, what hope have children got if even I, who would love to read, it's my greatest pleasure, if I'm finding I have to say to myself, put it down.
Yes, I know it is very hard. When you were young, what were the authors that you loved that really inspired you?
So definitely Enid Blyton.
Oh, my favourite.
Yes, you can definitely see her influence in my early writing. So my children, the characters in my books sound suspiciously English. So they have, you know, English accents. They're saying, what a jolly good idea and things like that. So, she was a big one. Mm. Mary Poppins books, I loved the Mary Poppins books. P.L. Travers, is that right? Anyway, I love the Mary Poppins books. And, of course, the Narnia series. And then I'm not sure, I remember that I was really quite embarrassingly grown up before it occurred to me that I should notice who wrote the books that I liked, that I would just grab a stack of books and then just read whatever came to me rather than thinking if I actually like a particular author, I should look for that author's books. So now as an author, I disapprove of that thinking, obviously.
Your books have the most wonderful characters, and I think you're very much known for these amazing characters that you put in all your books. When we're young, people's imagination flies and you come up with the most magical things and there's no, you know, you don't know too much about the world to stop your imagination. I wonder how that continued for you, that your imagination is so rich that you're able to really bring these characters to life in all your books.
I do notice in myself that when I'm writing as a grown-up, that I'm always trying to achieve what I used to achieve instantly as a child. So when I sat down to write, I would just write for the love of writing and I didn't analyze it too much. So I loved it in the same way that I loved riding my bike. So now I'll ride my bike, now I'll write a story. And I would just instantly lose myself in the story. Whereas now there are thousands of voices in my head each time I sit down to write, and critical voices and look at you, you're an author, this is your job, and what genre are you writing? So I always have to keep writing until I finally lose that sense of self and write the way I instantly wrote as a 10-year-old.
Do you think that is also an ego thing, putting the ego to the side to be able to just get into that flow?
Yeah, it's just losing your sense of self and flow, you know, athletes call it getting into the zone. And I think that creative flow is wonderful when you've reached that. And the only way to get there for me is by writing, just writing anything, just thinking to myself, doesn't matter if it's any good, just write anything for the next few, however many minutes. I've got this beautiful egg timer a friend gave me. And I think it goes for 30 minutes. And if you turn that over, then I think to myself, so you must write for the next 30 minutes without thinking anything. And then often then I finally lose.
I've interviewed a few of the leaders who speak about flow on the podcast before, a lot of Americans, and they talk a lot about being in that frame of mind and having make sure all distractions are put to the side. So do you turn your phone off or put it on silent and take off email notifications? Because they talk a lot about that.
Yes. So maybe you can tell me. So this is what I've always had that program Freedom, which stops internet access. And I always believed that freedom also stopped email from coming through, but apparently it doesn't. So I just believed that for years. And then somehow something happened where I thought, actually, email is coming through. So now I stop. So I've kept trying to work out how can I now, I don't want my email to come through. As soon as I knew that email was coming through, then I would go and check email. But I loved freedom because it was a way almost of programming myself. So I think, okay, I'm going to write the three, whatever time amount I'd put in. And then I'd think, I was like, now you're programmed to write for this amount of time.
Well, it isn't. And they say that when you're in that state, all time just dissipates. So you don't actually know. Well, you've got the timer there, but you don't know really how long you've been writing for, because you're in that flow state where you're just absolutely lost in writing about whatever you do. And they say for people who are doing work that you should always do your hardest task first. That's also a way of getting into flow, by doing that and achieving that and then kind of going into the smaller ones. But it is, I mean, it's like you said, a lot of athletes do it. A lot of really talk about it. It's like this thing going into a flow state and how much you really can achieve in it. And I would say authors, especially someone like you, would be, that flow state would help you achieve so much that you would find yourself in.
Yeah. It's interesting that they say do the hardest thing, because I find I need to do with something easy. So that's why I when I sit down at my manuscript, I could never just start writing a difficult scene. What I tend to do is write whatever, edit what I've written the day before or something that's, so because that's more pleasurable, and then I'm just warming up. So for me, it's like if I was thinking of it, if I do a spin class, you gotta warm up at the beginning. And it's horrible at the beginning and I hate it. And then, when you finally warm up, and then actually that's when I do start coming up with ideas for my work once something clicks in.
Well, clearly you've achieved a lot, so you keep doing what works for you. You've said that you don't actually plan your books. So do you just sit down and think, I'm going to, like, it's, I've got the next year. I've heard you say that you spend about a year or so writing a book. You've got a year. Do you have any idea about what you're going to write? How does it begin?
It just begins with the premise. So, for example, with Apples Never Fall, which is the newest book, then I had this premise of what, so the woman goes missing and the adult children are, considering the terrible possibility that their father may have killed their mother. So I had that premise, but I didn't know where she was. I didn't know if the father had actually murdered the mother. I didn't know the motivations. It's just the premise. And so it's a fun way to write, because when I sit down at my desk each day, I think, I wonder what's going to happen today. But it's also a scary way to write, because then I think, I hope something happens today. So I never want to give the impression that I just sit there and it all just flows out in this, because I'm so good at achieving a sense of flow that it just, all comes in an organized fashion. It doesn't. I just prefer to, so I have a scene. So, for example, even with what else? Forgot, a woman loses 10 years of her memory. So all I'm starting with is that very first scene, and as I'm writing it, that's helping me get to know the characters, and I'm considering and discarding possible ideas that maybe this will happen, maybe that will happen. And so I'm working it out as I go along. So I always have a separate document called Things I Need to Fix, because as I've worked out what's going to happen, obviously I'm going to now need to go back and change earlier chapters. Even once I've got to know my characters, then I'm thinking, well, now I know she wouldn't say this, or I've got little speech patterns as I've developed her, then I'll go back and put those in. I'll put in red herrings, I'll signpost certain things. And some things just happen to flow naturally, so I'll put something as part of the story, and then afterwards I'll think, oh, that could actually mean something else. And that's good when that happens, as opposed to having to go back and sort of shove in a jigsaw piece to make it work.
Do you base a lot of the characters on people in your life or people that you meet?
I will fully confess to helping myself to certain attributes of people. And sometimes I even start a character with one other person's attribute. So, for example, with the character of Madeline in Big Little Lies, I can always remember writing perpetually outraged like so-and-so and shimmery, sparkly girl like so-and-so. And so I had those two attributes and then I started writing her. But then something happens where she becomes completely herself. So Madeline is in fact nothing like the perpetually outraged friend or the shimmery friend. She's her own person. Mm-hmm. But it just helps, it's a starting point to have an attribute.
That is so unbelievably interesting. Do you have a vision of what they look like when you're writing?
I think sometimes I've been criticised that I don't describe my characters' looks enough. I do sometimes. So, for example, with this new book, the Joy Delaney, I can remember going for a walk and a woman walked by me and I thought, oh, there you are, Joy. She looked exactly the way I described her. So I think, but that was more, that was unusual because I think more about their personalities.
Yeah.
Than how they look. It doesn't really matter to me all that much whether they have, so, you know, Madeline in Big Little Lies had dark hair.
Yes.
Reese had the blonde hair. That, you know, wasn't something that was crucial to me.
Have you ever gone and told a person afterwards, this is who I actually based a lot of this character on you?
The shimmery girl, no, because I did take, actually, if I take a little story that somebody's told me, I will, I'll always ask, is it okay if there's some just tiny little anecdote from their life? And people love that.
Yeah, I was going to say, people would love that.
Yeah. So, yeah, sometimes if it's a little story, not normally. No, I actually don't take, I don't tell a particular attribute. I've never told that. It's if I take a little anecdote.
You obviously have a lot of New York Times bestsellers, but what I would like to know is your first New York Times bestseller was Husband's Secret. How did that feel to be on that such a prestigious list?
Well, it was just a career highlight. It was just one of the special moments of my life. And it wasn't really something, it wasn't a goal that I had. I was really just happy to be published. And it's not, I never think too much about the industry, which I think it's a good thing that I'm just focused on the story. And I felt really happy that I was allowed as my job to sit at my desk and write stories. But it was a huge thrill then when I got the news, and I can always remember I'd stopped and taken a phone call. I was just about to go to have breakfast with my little girl. I dropped my little boy off at school and I got the call that it had hit the New York Times bestseller list, and I can remember carrying her into the cafe and whispering into her ear that Mummy just became a New York Times bestseller. And so it just feels magical, really. But my son, he's seen this TikTok video that says, why is every book a New York Times bestseller? So he makes fun of me and says, nothing that special about being a New York Times bestseller.
It's so funny you say that, because when I do my introductions for the podcast, the audio producer, I record them with him, he says, Sarah, have you ever interviewed someone who is not a New York Times bestseller? And I said, I interview the best in the world. I can't help it if they've all got New York Times bestsellers.
So, there are dozens.
But it's so unbelievably prestigious. Do you have a feeling, this will be a New York Times bestseller when you finished? Or does it surprise you still?
No, I don't have a feeling. No, and I don't. And in a way, I really need to separate myself from all that, because I think then I would get too caught up in thinking, you know, they liked certain things, the readers appreciated certain things.
Mm.
And I do tend to sort of come back to familiar themes anyway, so it's not like I'm doing anything that different. But if I deliberately said, now I'm going to do this, this and this because that's what worked before. Having said that, you know, I'm just keep fact-checking myself. I do remember after The Husband's Secret came out, which took a darker, more suspenseful turn than my previous books. And I can remember my American editor saying to me, I can't remember her exact words, but it was something along the lines of, you know, readers seem to really appreciate that. So she was basically saying, do that again. And I guess I did. I enjoyed the suspenseful turn, so I can't really say, you know, I'm such an artist, I'm doing whatever I want with each book. I know readers enjoyed the fact that I took a darker turn, so I've kept with that. So I don't know. It's so hard to be objective about your own work when I finished it. I'm in a state of agony, really, to think, will people? I don't know. That's why. So I've got two sisters who are authors, and as soon as we finish writing a manuscript, we send it to each other, and our only job is to say to each other within an amazingly short time, this is a masterpiece, this is the best thing you've ever written, just because it's you don't know it, you can't see it.
Well, that's an interesting topic, talking about now criticism, or I shouldn't say criticism, helpful advice. I know even with the podcast, I mean, I have a very tight unit of people that give me feedback that I trust, and I'm open to hearing things from people here and there. But I also know that if you can get very overwhelmed with all these different people's opinions. So whose opinion do you take? For you, who do you lean on to give you feedback?
Well, really, so my two sisters, and also because I've got different publishers in Australia, US and UK, so I've got different editors. So I do feel like I've got enough people ready to give me constructive criticism as part of the editorial process.
Yes.
So they're the ones that I rely on the most. Yeah, and it is always difficult, the editorial process. So when you first get the editorial report, my first reaction is, no, I don't want anything. And then you've got to sort of think, you've got to let it sit with you for a bit. And then I'm grateful for the editorial process. And then there's the next level of readers. But I don't read reviews anymore. So when I first started writing, I used to it was part of my daily routine to check my Amazon reviews, but I haven't looked at Amazon now in years because little things just get stuck in your head. It's and it's that human nature that you'll remember the negative.
Yeah.
You'll remember one negative comment out of however many good comments.
It's so true. It is such a wise thing. I think Olivia Newton-John had told me, Seth Godin has told me that they stopped reading reviews a long time ago because, absolutely to your point, the negative ones are the ones that stay in your head, and then your self-esteem gets kind of knocked a bit, and it's not such a great thing. I mean, you know in yourself, and you have the close people, like you said, around you, and really that should be enough. And I'm sure you get a lot of emails, or your publishers would be able to tell you all the beautiful emails that readers write in about.
Yeah, I get the good comments really, I won't get this time so much because when I go on tour and I meet readers, so it has really clarified for me actually, the pandemic, the things that matter to me are the actual writing part and then just the meeting readers. But yes, to the actual reviews from critics, it gets too caught in your head, so much so that I can remember sometimes thinking, after reading a review, thinking, oh, well, thank goodness I don't have another book out for another 2 or 3 years. She can't hurt me again, which is terrible to think I'm safe now because I haven't got anything and I can just go and write again.
And, you know, half the time these people sometimes are just trolls. Like, they probably even haven't read your book properly. It's just a negative comment based on nothing.
Yeah, or it is their view, and that's part of my job, that I do have to accept that it's just literally not possible to please everyone. So, for example, with the sort of books that I write, part of the difficulty that I had taken this suspenseful turn, but I'm not really writing pure suspense. So sometimes I think people pick up my books thinking it's going to be a real page turner, a real thriller, and then they get impatient because I'm doing too much, you know, I'm delving into a particular character, which some of my readers love that.
Yeah.
So I can't please the person who wants the page turner as well as pleasing my readers who love the going off on detours on characters' backstories.
How did you come to that sense of peace, being able to not please everyone?
No, I haven't come. I'm just saying that out loud.
Yeah. I knew it. I don't think I'm there either, so I get it.
No, I accidentally saw because somebody put something on my author page and they put it on today saying, I know some readers are saying it's a slow burn, but I love it. And of course, in my head, all I can hear is slow burn. So as I'm saying that, that's what I mean. She loved it. The ones who wanted to say it's a slow burn, I can't please them. There's nothing I can do about it. There's no peace. I thought I had achieved it with this most recent book because I took longer to write it and I loved the process of writing it so much. And I remember actually listening to a podcast. I can't remember. He might have been an actor and he spoke so passionately saying something about how if you've given your heart to something, then criticism can't hurt you. And I thought that, I remember I had a moment where I thought, well, I have given my heart to this book, so criticism won't hurt me. And I thought momentarily that I'd achieved enlightenment and that I'd self-actualized and it didn't matter anymore, but it didn't. No, it didn't last. I still care.
It needs to be your mantra every morning when you wake up.
Yes, that's right.
It's. I remember talking to Mark Manson and he was saying that after he went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, there was that depression that followed after that he writes about in his second book. And it was for him, it was that high and then it's, well, now what? Did you ever feel anything like that?
I think it was a bit different for me because it was my fifth novel that had got there. So I think it would be really hard if your first novel has a huge success. I didn't have that. So in a way, I feel lucky that I had those books that were just going along, being what they call a mid-list author. And so I knew I loved the actual writing of the books. So I didn't really experience that.
You obviously have Big Little Lies and Nine Perfect Strangers, which have been adapted to on screen. And Big Little Lies just won so many Emmys. It was amazing. And Nine Perfect Strangers is on now. I'm watching it every week. I wish there was more than one episode. I hate that I have to wait until I love it when Thursday rolls around. But I also find it like, damn, I think every single person that I know is watching that. How does it feel to achieve that, to know that your books have then made it onto screen and having such amazing actors in them?
Oh, well, I just feel very lucky, really, that the adaptations were so wonderful and that they both attracted such incredible casts. So I think that's, for me, that's just pure luck and feels like a real perk of the job. So I know some authors are not as lucky as I've been in that I handed it over, but they kept me involved.
The executive producer I saw on Nine Perfect Strangers.
Executive producer, yeah, but that's an honorary title.
I still handed it over.
So that's in recognition for my contribution, which is the book. It's not, it doesn't mean that I was there saying, stand over there. And I'm just grateful for that. But for me, as I say, it's a perk of the job. It's just a real, and it's been pure fun. Mm. But that's all their talents that are coming into it. For me, still the end result is always the book, and that's between me and the reader. So that yes. feels really personal, and I'm in charge of that world. So, you know, every single actor, for example, in Nine Perfect Strangers, every single one of them, they brought their own interpretation and their own talent to each character. And that's incredible, and they do, and it's a completely different art form. But I still love when I'm in charge of my world, and I meet a reader who they talk about things from their own experiences and why they loved the book, or yeah. or things. You know, if they had some times, people would talk about really difficult times in their lives where my books helped get them through. Because they're easy reads, maybe they were at the hospital with a sick relative and things like that. So it's really personal and special.
I was going to ask you, is there a letter or an email that you remember? Because I know I have a couple with the podcast that sticks out the most because of how someone said it changed their life.
There's quite a few that stand out. I can remember the very first person who ever sent me a message. Her name was Rebecca. I remember that because I considered naming my first child after, because I quite like the name Rebecca too. So the very first person, but then there are people who've written to say after Big Little Lies, after reading the novel, one person said, well, was this... So there's people who come up in the signing line at yes. book events, and I think one person came up and said something about that she showed her book to all of us, showed my book to each of her friends and said, this is me, I want you to read the book, so that that was her way of telling them, this is what I've been going through. So she'd got out of an abusive relationship. So some people have written to say that they, from reading the book, they recognised that they were in an abusive relationship and left because of it. And then there are people who were going through infertility, so that What Alice Forgot meant a lot to them. I remember a few people saying What Alice Forgot is about a woman who loses 10 years of her memory, so she thinks she's only about to turn 30. Mm. Really, she's about to turn 40. And a lot of women who were in their early 40s wanted to tell me that they'd had really in-depth conversations with their partners because it made them really think about how have we changed over the last 10 years. So that was really special. There's a character in The Husband's Secret with a particular health condition, which a woman wrote to me and said, from reading my book, she diagnosed her own daughter
wow.
with this health condition that she then... It's an unusual syndrome, and she then took her and had a diagnosis. So that's incredible.
Incredible.
So many. It's really, really special.
Did you ever think that you'd be changing people's lives?
No, and no. It's purely set out to write a story, to just have a book at the end of it. No, so it's incredible.
There must be such a sense of satisfaction, because you're giving back in such a way that, I mean, you are being creative and you're just writing what comes to you. But when you know that you're actually changing people's lives and saving lives, I mean, what an incredible feeling that must be.
Yeah, it really was, yeah.
And going back to it being on screen, how much say do you have once they start filming? Are you ever there, or do you see the scripts before?
I preferred to be quite hands-off.
Yeah.
So I always felt that if I started becoming too involved, I would hold on too tightly. And I always felt that adaptations should not be too faithful, that there are certain things that you need to change, but that I would naturally not want to change things. So I've been asked if I wanted to write the screenplay, but because I don't plan my books, because I don't know what's going to happen, to me there's no pleasure in writing an adaptation of my own work because I already know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So to me, I can think of nothing more boring than adapting my own work. So no, as I said, I've been so lucky because I've been kept involved, but only from a, you know, do you want to see this? Do you want? And I've got come along to visit the set. So it's like being part of something without actually having to do anything.
How did Nicole Kidman get involved? I mean, firstly, she's Australian, which must be really nice to have an Aussie being such a big part of both Nine Perfect Strangers and Big Little Lies. How did that association with you come to fruition?
I think the link is Bruna Papandrea, who is an Australian producer who was working with Reese Witherspoon at the time. And I think Bruna might have seen the manuscript for Big Little Lies first, or she knew somebody had seen it. So I think, and Bruna was friends with Nicole, had worked with Nicole before. So as a result, Nicole and Reese together optioned Big Little Lies.
And now you have your new book, which is Apples Never Fall. Tell us a bit about that and what was the inspiration for writing that book?
So Apples Never Fall is the story of Joy and Stan Delaney, who are retired tennis coaches, and what happens when Joy goes missing and her four adult children have to deal with the terrible possibility that their father may have murdered their mother. And I came to that, there are a few different little sparks. So one spark was, like Joy in the book, I got some fancy headphones, some fancy wireless headphones from my husband as a gift, and I got into podcasts a little bit late. And like most people, I started listening to some true crime podcasts.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this premise of the missing wife, and how would you feel if you people were believing it was your father. And then once I had that premise, I was thinking, well, it would be ideal if I then had, so I've got four children, because then they can have different reactions to this happening, and you can have factions forming. So that was one spark. Another spark, I remember reading an article about a young woman who knocked on the door of an elderly couple's house late at night and asked to be let in. And there was a criminal case as a result of that. I'm not sure exactly what that incident was, but what stuck in my mind was just this knocking on the door and this elderly couple trying to do the right thing, and they let her in. So I had that as another spark. So I had no idea how those two things would come together. And the third thing was that I was having what I was calling, very self-indulgently, a year of joy, which was, fortunately, it was 2019, not 2020, where I was giving myself a year off, and I was thinking I wouldn't start a new novel just yet. I was thinking I'd just write for the pleasure of writing. And I asked my sister Jackie to send me a writing prompt, and I thought I'd just write something, maybe a story or whatever came of it. And she sent me just a 3 or 4 line prompt, which was about a bike lying on the grass underneath a tree with a few apples lying on the grass next to the bike. And so that became the opening scene of the book, because it turned out, and I, from that prompt, I didn't just write some little piece, I just ended up writing a novel. So it was good that the Year of Joy clarified that actually writing novels brings me joy. And that's how I also came up with that character's name, because I think I was originally calling the book The Year of Joy, but the main character's name is Joy.
What did you do in your year of joy?
Yeah, I didn't do much. I remember my husband and I saying, I feel like that was a practice year. I might need to try again. I was only just settling into it. We had some lovely holidays. I did a Scandinavian book tour and then a holiday with my family, which was so grateful that we did, because all the travelling stopped after that. So I thought I'd listen to music and read poetry and all that sort of thing. And I think really what it just did, because I had longer than usual to write my next book, it just allowed me to, it took the pressure off.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking if this doesn't work, I can throw it away. And it really, I loved writing. So really I just lived my normal life really.
I mean, obviously that you took a bit of time off to give yourself a bit of a break. Did you really miss the writing?
Yes, I did. So that's exactly what happened, I thought, I'm not sure what to do with myself then. I'm not really good at this. I'm not the sort of person who could be, some people would be good at being I don't know why I'm saying a diplomat's wife. I'm sure some diplomat's wives lead very wonderful, but a life where, or just in a life of art where you're just going off to galleries and all that sort of thing. I can't actually do that. I'm more task-oriented than I thought I was. I needed to, and I still had my deadline. It was just further down the track. There just wasn't enough in the day to...
Was it like your sense of purpose? I mean, obviously your purpose is so many things, but your own personal one, so not being a mother or a wife or whatever else, it's that thing that you do for you that brings you so much joy?
I think so. I think that is what I discovered. And you can easily fill your days as
absolutely.
As a mother with children, with domestic duty. But that wasn't enough. It did feel like what's the point? And also, I think I realized that when I first started writing my very first book, that my feeling that I had at that time was a sense of relief, because after all those years of wanting to write and not writing, I was finally writing. And so that's why I was always so grateful to my sister for giving me that push to do it. And the same thing happened in this year of joy that I've, faffed about for a few months and then thought, oh, it's a relief when I'm actually started writing from that writing prompt again. It feels like I got something done each day.
And I mean, a lot of people talk about it not being work when it's something that you love. So it's not like you drop the kids off at school and then it's like, oh, I've got to go sit and at my desk and write. It's like, wow, this is what I love doing. I mean, how exciting and fun that I get to go sit and whatever happens, happens.
Mm. Well, it's such a privilege. It really, really is.
Do you think... if your book stopped doing well, that you would stop writing?
That's such an interesting question. If I stopped being published, I don't know what I would do. I don't think that's part of the process for me. That's part of the other side of the coin, is having the readers and having the finished book at the end. I don't think I would just sit there and write for the sake of writing. So I like the fact that I'm published. I wouldn't just write. I enjoyed having the extra time for this book. So normally I have a book out every 2 years. This has been 3 years. I don't think I'd like to take 10 years to write a book. I think I would then really miss the having the readers at the other end. So if I had no publisher, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is.
What book that you've written has brought you the most joy?
It would be actually a toss-up between Three Wishes, because it was my first book and it was that incredible sense of relief, as I said, that I felt, and it was a sense of exhilaration that I was actually doing it. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. There are a lot of writers who want to write and are too frightened to write. So that incredible sense of satisfaction that when you're finally doing it, that was fantastic back then. And then this most recent book, because I did take that take more time, and something from that year of joy, I don't know what happened. I just loved writing it.
Do you have a feeling that, I mean, I think it will do extremely well, but do you have a feeling that Apples Never Fall will do well?
I don't know. In a way, it's not. It feels different to me, but every book feels different. But in a way, it's also, typical Leah Moriarty style.
Yeah.
So some people will say, there she is writing to her formula again, whereas to me I feel it's completely different. But it's funny, then once I've finished writing, I think, oh, I've done this again. I didn't mean to do that again. But because it's me, you come back to certain themes.
But isn't that what's so amazing about that it is you? I mean, I have a style when I interview people as well, and that's, you're known for that. And that's only you have that, and that's what makes it special. Yes,
that's right, and that's it's just part of that. It's, as we were saying earlier, it's just that voice in your head. It's just somebody there's a little line that I would have read somewhere saying there she is trotting out her formula again. Whereas, of course, other people, and I know that myself from books I read, I Anne Tyler is one of my favourite authors, and as soon as I'm in there, I recognise her style and her type of characters, and it's glorious.
That's what you love, yeah.
Yeah. So you're right. Should ignore that voice. Yes, I hope so.
Have you ever suffered writer's block?
Not so much. I always feel it's a mistake to label it as writer's block.
Yeah.
What
is that? You know, you're a writer. I mean, we all think it's just when someone sits there and nothing comes to their mind about what they should write. Is that what it is?
I don't know. It's just, I think if you take it too seriously, then you could think I am suffering from writer's block.
Yeah.
So I would never call it writer's block. I'd just say I'm not having a good day today, and I just need to do all the things that that I know will bring it back, which is either doing my egg timer, just write for 30 minutes and lose yourself, or if that's not working, exercise is, I always find works, or you need to stop for a week, you need a week off. Or maybe you need a year off. Maybe you need a year of joy.
Yeah,
but no, so I'm going to say I don't believe in it.
You obviously have the egg timer, but is there anything that you do, anything you say, like a ritual before you go down to ride every day?
No, but I have thought about that a lot.
Some people might say a prayer, not a religious one, but I know a lot of people I've spoken to who are authors ask, I mean, they're more spiritual, but for the divine to write through them and things like that, which are really beautiful.
Yes, it sounds beautiful. And I wish I did have something like that. I might create it for the next book. I've been listening, since I got into podcasts, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts about meditation.
Yes.
Without actually doing a single moment of meditation, just learning about the process of it. So I like the idea of sitting there and maybe doing a little 3-minute meditation or something or a mantra. But no, I've got nothing except for that program, the programming myself and the egg timer.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given?
I remember reading Stephen King's book on writing where he was saying he was a word counter, and I think he was advising to write 2,000 words a day. And I write, my rule is just 500 words a day. So I think just because I'm not a planner, so therefore the temptation is always to go back and look over what you've written the day before. So to say to myself, you must write 500 words a day. So that's just one little thing, really, that I became a word counter. Often at the time they feel very important. I think maybe not to hold on to anything too tightly. And I've written that down somewhere. My mother and my grandmother always had these habits of writing little quotes on little bits of paper, and I'm turning into them. So that's probably on my desk somewhere.
But I do that too with the notes in my phone.
Yes. I don't know where it is, but it's something like, so whether it's something wonderful or something terrible, to try not to hold on to
anything
too tightly.
Oprah says that. She says, believe it, know it, and then let it go. Never hold on too tight.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite book? If you think of all the books that you've ever read, is there one or two that really stand out that you just adore?
I would say The Accidental Tourist by Anne Tyler. So I do have, I'm not sure if you can see it off screen, but my American editor did give me a signed first edition of The Accidental Tourist. And I would save that in a fire. So that's a very special book to me also because I think it gave me permission to write about ordinary people. So I can remember reading it, and it's got some siblings in it who are always getting lost whenever they go anywhere. They know they're going to get lost. And my sister and I, we're always getting lost. And it was a little revelation to me that something so ordinary that I could have written about that and thinking to myself, so all, it's okay, you can write about really ordinary parts of life and it's a pleasure to read. So she really inspired me to write about ordinary suburban people.
Well, I think the ordinary parts of life is what's so relatable, because that's where 99% of your audience would be when they're writing it.
Yes, that's the case. Most of us are leading ordinary.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to read historical fiction and of course to read about people who are living lives completely different from ours. We need all those sorts of stories. But I think, yeah, we also need stories about people who are like us.
It's funny you say that, because I'm Hamish and Andy's producer and their comedy is ordinary, relatable comedy, and Tony Martin I interviewed the other day and he says it's about taking the ordinary and making it extremely funny. And that's what gets the most laughs, because everyone can relate to it.
I know, that is. I can always remember Jamoan doing some little, he was doing something about teaspoons in the sink and how when you turn the tap on and he was looking at it and thinking, oh, that's right, that always happens when the water.
Yeah.
And it was such a tiny little, that is the best comedy when you relate to it so much.
And it's interesting from an author's point of view as well, because it makes so much sense.
Mm.
What is the lesson that has taken you the longest to learn?
Oh, I don't think I've learned it yet. It probably would have been that lesson that I was talking about earlier, about that it's literally impossible to please everyone with my work. So I just have to keep saying that until I really believe it. And I believe it as I'm saying it, but then when the next time I see something that's criticism, it will still upset me. But I think I am getting better
at that. I'm sure you are.
Pick up, yeah.
What is a life of greatness to you?
Just having love in your life, having people who love you and who you love.
Leanne, thank you for all of the books that you have given us. You have brought so much joy to so many people. So thank you very much for the conversation today.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. You've given me a lot to think about.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my ebook, Finding Greatness, head to sarahgrimberg.com. And if you love what you heard, then we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. A Life of Greatness's executive producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Audio producers Matt Curry and Nicola Sitch. Special thanks to Grant Tothill for bringing this dream to life. For more episodes, search A Life of Greatness podcast, download the new listener app now, and listen for free. Listener.